entitled it exponential lower bound for two clearly locally decodable codes via a non-quantum number. So let's start. Is apologies, right? So I'm deciding every talk to start with some apologies. So I have three things to apologize about. So first of all, I want to apologize for stealing Ronan's title. So I changed quantum to non-quantum, but second, of course, I want to apologize for presenting a different proof for a known result. And third, you know, I want to apologize for using slides and not PowerPoint, especially since there were some technical problems. So the colors blue and black at some point start to disappear, so I'll try to manage. Great. So apologies are over, let's start with motivation. One does have to motivate presenting a proof of a known result, right? Why do we do this? So the basic motivation is somehow the disgraceful state of affairs we have with regards to the circular locally decodable code. So right, so the locally decodable code expands little n bits to capital N bits so that there is a coding algorithm A which can recover, can guess any bit of the original message by looking at Q bits of the encoded message. So with two bits, we have constructions with capital and exponential and little n, and there are lower bounds, which sort of match the constraints. Great. So now for string query, this is very bad. Can you see this? Right, so with three queries, this is very bad. The best bound is by Boudreau, the best lower bound. Capital N is quadratic, quadratic over some, over a logarithm in a little n. And we have no idea whether it's tight or not, right? So, and it's basically Sergei's fault, right? So, until like a month ago, everybody knew that the right answer is 2 to the square root of n. For larger number of queries, there are some results by Bergman et al., which are better, but for three queries, everybody knew that the lower bound is 2 to the square root of n, and this is a nice goal to shoot for, right? But now we have no idea what the right answer is, and this is very good. So, you know, I should ask several people to make a guess about the right answer, and nobody will come to himself. Right, so, this could be tight. All we know, it could be quadratic. Right, so a modest step in sort of in the right direction to understand the three query case is sort of to have an easier proof for the two query case, right? So the proof we have just heard is quantum and uses complicated tools from quantum information theory. So, and you know, people who are quantum handicapped, as I am, are sort of, we don't understand, right? So let's say we try to prove elementary in this sense. Great. So the goal of this talk is to present an elementary proof of the two query case of the exponential lower bound. And I should mention some results. Some work has been done in this direction. So there is a result by Jane from this year. So he deals with the case or the error with the epsilon, sort of the advantage is very close to 1/2. The error is very, very small. And apparently, as David Woodruff told me, pointed out this could be done. In this case, this is actually very easy. And there is a unwritten result of Obata, which, for all I know, might be very similar to what I'm going to talk about, but it's not written, and apparently it's never going to be written, so I don't know. We can imagine this is basically similar to what I'm going to talk about. So the plan which is similar, so now we go to the proof of the lower bound, and the plan is similar to the structure of the proof. proof of Pyrenees and the book. So there are three steps. The first step, we reduce the question about logarithmical codes to a clean combinatorial question. The next step, we translate this question to a linear algebraic question, a question on positive semi-definite matrices. And the last step, we solve this question of positive semi-definite matrices using tools for linear algebra. Right, no quantum information. And the main tool we are going to use is majorization. This is a notion of convexity, I'm going to explain. It's a metric notion, very useful. Right, so this is the plan. So now, okay, I am most interested in the third step. This is basically the hard technical part, which I want to sort of to explain in more detail. But I want to explain the first two steps. So I have two transparencies for each one of these steps, and I'm slightly worried about these. Sort of two transparencies don't seem to be enough. So I'm going, and the first step is by now classical. The first step is basically a survey of known results by and Trevisan, and Goldreich, Karloff, Schumann, and Trevisan. And I'm going to sort of to pass through this step relatively quickly, and once again, I'm worried. But you know, but this is modular. So after I'm through the first step, if it annoyed you or you sort of lost the sort of the thing, you can forget about it and, you know, and start with the second step. And if there's a problem with the second step, you just I'll tell you the precise moments that you start listening to. Right. So okay, so here are the two slides for the first step of the combinatorial question. So we all know what a U query local decodable code is, but let me just repeat. So what's a decoding algorithm for a Q query local decodable code? So it's basically an n-tuple of distributions. Pi is a distribution over Q subset of the code for universe. So what the algorithm does, given a bit I, sort of required bit I of the message, what he does, he chooses a Q subset of indices of the code word according to the distribution Pi. And what he does, sort of, and what the algorithm does, it decides on the bit it returns, and this bit is basically a Boolean function over a q-dimensional Boolean. It's basically just repeating. Right, so the algorithm chooses a q subset and computes a Boolean function which depends on the bit I and on the subset. I would be happy for questions. Okay, good. So now we'll make several remarks which will sort of make things easier and not basically lose anything. So the first remark is the following. So the algorithm should be able to manage a corrupted code word. A code word corrupted in a linear number of positions. This means that we cannot store relevant information in a small number of positions, right? In all little of n, capital N positions, because it could be corrupted. And this actually means that the algorithm would be stupid if it would access some bits of the code word with probability higher than some constant over n, because it could access only a small number of bits, and these bits could be corrupted. So the first step is understanding that we can assume that for each bit, for each position of the code word, and for each position in the message, the probability of accessing, if given an index I of the position in the message you want to recover, the probability that the algorithm looks at a bit j, the position j in the code word, the probability according to the distribution pi is 1 over n, it's a constant over n. So I hope this, you can see this black. And this blue thing, the indices, I suppose, cover some of the questions. So this is the smooth local decodable code. Any position I look at this probability basically 1 over the constant over. Now, since the algorithm does succeed in recovering the ith bit, as a good guess, at least some Q subsets of indices the algorithm looks at carry some information about the ISP thread, otherwise it will fail. There are some informative Q tuples of bits that give information about the ISP. And so on, here is the next step. So for each I, there are at least, there are many informative Q sets S I can look at. What this means is that the probability over the code, the messages, that if an algorithm looks at the probability, if the algorithm looks at S, at this Q tuple of bits S in the code word, the probability that it returns XI is greater than 1/2, and this is 1/2 plus some epsilon prime, if you could see this. So this S, this Q set S, is called an informative Q. Sure. Well, Q is constant, right? So for a Q, the number of queries is constant here.
But then you end with a Q.
I'm sorry?
I mean, then you'll be end with a Q, right?
No.
Oh, disjoint.
No, they're not disjoint yet. They will be disjoint in a second. Right, but so how many Q sets we need? Right, since I access each bit is probability 1 over n, and Q is constant, I need at least that many informative Q sets, otherwise I wouldn't touch them, right? Otherwise I would access all of them with very small probability. So this is reasonable, okay? Right, so we need one more step, and this is it. The last step is that now, so we have these omega capital N informative Q sets. It cannot be that they all intersect a very small number of positions, because then I could corrupt these positions. This is also a very easy argument. And this immediately answers the
question.
I'm sorry?
Why there are omega of n of
them? Well, see, I access each bit is probability 1 over n. And they are finite size. If there was a smaller number of such sets, I wouldn't access them at all. I would get no end of it, right?
So that was, I suppose, smoothness is theta. Okay.
Yes. Okay, and the last step is that actually we have omega of n disjoint in probability Q sets, because they don't all touch some small number of points. This is very easy and very neat. Good. So here's the combinatorial problem we have arrived at. And we are going to try and solve this problem. Here's the combinatorial problem. It looks a mess. Let's go over it and then we can prove it. Right? So yeah, it's very dense, but you know, we can try and go over it. So we have two parameters between 0 and 1/2. Epsilon is the advantage of the algorithm. Alpha is some other parameter, which will be sort of clear in a second. We have Q is the number of queries. N is the size of the message set. This is the message universe. The capital N is the code word. And R is just the number, this number of disjoint informative Q sets. And R is some alpha. So this alpha only appears here. R is some constant times capital N.
What's
smaller
again? Sorry.
R is this, so we just said that we have an omega. We have this omega of n disjoint informative Q sets.
Oh,
this is
R.
This is R.
Okay.
Right. So, and here's what is the assumption? There is this encoding from 0, 1 to little n to 0, 1 to capital N. And we have Q subsets, Sij, I goes between 1 and n, and j goes between 1 and r. These are the informative subsets for each one of the i's. The notation is similar to Sergei's notation yesterday in some points. And we have functions, fij. So fij is a function the algorithm uses when the algorithm accesses the same message. And we have so what are the conditions for all I, for each I, the sets Sij are disjoint, as we said. And we have this advantage, the probability over all the messages. If I access Sij and apply to the function Fij, this is the decision function, the probability that I recover the bit Xi is greater than 1/2. Can you see this from the back? I mean, the blue is really bad. But is it, does it sound reasonable? This is basically the whole mathematical question. These are the informative windows, the Sijs. So what does the algorithm do? Given I, it chooses basically one of the Sijs uniformly at random, and computes only the function fij, and this should return the function. It's a bit xi with some advantage. This is the whole question.
Wait,
what sense did you simplify the disjointness of the simplification? Well, no, I didn't simplify it. I could put it on one slide, basically, the whole problem, right? Without saying anything about codes. It's a combinatorial problem, subsets and stuff. I don't know. It looks cleaner to me, but it. Yeah, so that's a good question.
Have a code.
I agree. I mean, this is, yeah. Why does it come in, or how does it come in, or what? So you have this omega of n informative sets, right? They couldn't all pass through one bit because they would corrupt this bit. So they're a finite size. So I could take the joint.
It's not that they're just trying to start with.
No. You lose a factor of Q, say, or something, right? But you know, Q is a constant. Right. So here is one new thing. I could sort of make an assumption that these functions fij are balanced. Why could I do that? This is because the xi is balanced, right? Xi is a bit of the message. If I go over all the x's, xi is balanced. So if I have a non-balanced function, which guesses xi with high probability, I could balance it then, you know, I'd not lose guesses. And this function depends on at least two bits. See, if I have a function which depends only on one bit, so the best thing you could do is just return xi. But then it would be useless for other bits, right? So, good. So now here's the question, how large is capital N should be as a function of little n, Q, alpha, and epsilon? Rick?
But do you say that fi would be balanced?
Well, just because xi, fij tries to guess xi.
But because
it's fij,
does it have to have uniform distribution?
Say it again?
The code itself, the theory of x is...
Fine, but I'm trying to recover xi, right? Overall, but xi is balanced over the.
So if
fij
is not balanced, how
do you change
it to be balanced
with
small loss?
Right. So you know, it could be done. It's like a two-liner, and it's something has to be done about it. I really don't want to go into it, but it's easy and it's true. And it's a proof by intimidation. This is basically this. this could be done. So actually, as some people pointed out to me, we can actually take fij's to the source, in fact, just by expanding this Boolean function in a Fourier basis and losing some constant factor, but
in Q.
Yeah.
So because you haven't lost anything in Q, you're just lost in the probability.
Right. So here we lose 2 to the Q or something, but I don't care about this also. Right.
I'm just curious, presumably the constructive code which works for any x, which is, you know, no matter what the input x is, if you say only if the input x is random,
that's a good point. Okay, good. So there is this quote saying that, you know, a little inaccuracy sometimes saves tons of explanation, but here I'm sort of people are catching me. So I'm losing here. By taking this fij to be balanced, I'm still keeping my advantage on average over all the x's. But there could be some x's which are sort of, you know, which behave worse. There could be some inputs for which I couldn't recover the I speed. But on the average, I am keeping my advantage, and this is what I mean. You know, there is this is still true. This thing is still true because I take the probability over all x's. This is still true. Okay, so this is a mathematical formulation. Does it help? It's not immediately clear, but in fact it does. And this was basically the step. These were the steps taken by Katz and Trevisan, which led to non-linear lower bound using this bit. Okay. Good. So this is the first step. Now we can forget all about it. We go to the next step, which is the linear algebra formulation. Great. So the sort of the main idea here is now instead of thinking. Think about matrices. And now Q equals 2. Now we are back to the binary alphabet. And let me just remind you that Q is 2, and now fij's are now functions on two bits, which are balanced and depend on both bits. There are only two functions. There are XOR and XOR complement. Two balanced functions depending on two bits. So here is the last iteration. Is that both XOR and XOR complement could be simulated by an action of a positive semi-definite matrix, which I think is exactly the same as it could be similar to like quantum queries, but I'm not sure. So here is the thing. So here is a table of XOR of 2 bits, Y1 and Y2, and for a good reason, I have now replaced, which will be clear in a second, I have replaced Y1 and Y2 are now bits in 1 minus 1 and 0, which of course, so here is a table of the XOR function. If the two input bits are equal to XOR 0, if they're not equal to XOR 1. So, and here is this lucky thing, I could recover this function by multiplying the input vector y by a positive semi-definite, by a 2x2 positive semi-definite matrix p. This is, once again, I'm sure for people from quantum computing, this is basically, you know, cheating. This is, it's affecting this trivial sort of fact in quantum computation, you know, the common language, but for people who are not from quantum computing, this could be so great. So here is this, so this action of computing sort could be simulated by this positive semi-definite linear form. Is this okay? Now this is direct computation. So y transpose py equals, this is the table of this. And the same for XOR complex. There's another group. So it seems that I'm losing the audience.
How are you representing bits?
Sorry?
How are you representing bits?
What, one?
No, but why one and
why? So y is a vector of length 2, 1. The representation problem is bad, but so could you tell me? I'm not sure about the. Is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Questions, please.
So, I'm not assuming that these functions, the covered functions, are XOR.
I understand that XOR could be similar. This is, you know.
But you're not saying that, that these
FIs. FIs are balanced and depend on 2 bits, they're either XOR or XOR. Okay?
Sure.
Sure.
That's true, but then, but
yeah,
and
in
you can, but you will fail at some other point. But the, for a larger number of queues. But you know, let's for Hugo's to everything goes. Is it clear the same? There are two, some, you know, call it a gadget, right? You have this trick. You can
so
simulate XOR and XOR complement by a positive semi-definite matrix of size.
The bits are minus 1 and 1.
Sorry.
The bits are minus 1.
Yes. Yes. The bits are minus 1.
And the result of XOR is 0 and 1.
And 0 and 1. Yes. This is a lucky thing, right? It goes through. So here, and now we construct this matrix, so we have this. Question, yeah?
PSD,
positive semi-definite matrix of size 2 over 0, whatever. A 2x2 positive semi-definite matrix over 0. This is a bad notation. This is a positive semi-definite matrix, a 2x2 positive semi-definite matrix over the real numbers. Positive semi-definite means when you multiply, you know, both sides by a vector, you get a non-negative answer, always. So y transpose py is always non-negative for any vector, for any real vector y.
So the vector y in y py is the same as y1 and y2.
So no. So y is a vector y1, y2, y2. Y is a vector of length 2. Its coordinates y1, y2. Okay. Right. So it's a fact, you know, it's easy and you sort of have to believe it. But now when I have this, I can construct a large positive semi-definite matrix which simulates the whole decoding algorithm. This is basically, and how is this matrix constructed? This is a block matrix which has 2x2 matrices on the diagonal. So at what places? At the coordinates given by Sij, which is a set of these two coordinates, I am putting either Q or P, one of these positive semi-definite matrices according to the function Fij, to the recovery function Fij. Is it okay?
So the recovery
sure.
matrix is a XOR or a...
The recovery matrix for 2 bits. For each 2-bit Boolean function is a XOR or XOR complement and could be simulated by a positive semi-definite matrix. So now if I want to simulate the whole
because
decoding algorithm...
Is it because you're balanced?
Because.
Okay.
So the whole decoding algorithm, what it does, it chooses at random positions Sij and computes the function Fij. So I'm simulating it. I'm just putting the corresponding matrices in corresponding positions, and this is it.
These 2-bit matrices are in
consecutive positions? Well, if the picture is this way. It doesn't have to be right, but it doesn't matter. It's easier to draw this.
Different lines.
Sorry?
Because they're disjoint.
They're disjoint. The important thing is disjointness, right?
If you do all these implementations for each I, then they'll not run, all of them are not going to be.
No, of course not. This is for a particular I. Right? This is EI, right?
So the decoding of I.
I'll say this in a second. So we have to apply this to something. This is a decoding algorithm. It has to be applied to some encoding thing. And I'll describe the encoding in a second, but let me draw this code. Sure.
Just
yeah.
So what is this set that J ranges over? Is that 1 to R or 1 to
K? 1 to R. One to
why is the dimension like instead of R by R?
No, but I have many zeros around here, right? There are not zero.
Also the diagonal is zero.
Yeah, I also have zero on the diagonal. So all the positions which are not taken by this 2x2 matrix are zeros.
And you have the I is used twice, right? Once is the index you want to reconstruct, and once is the entries in the vector that you're reading. Am I right?
It could be true, but I'm not sure. EI, is
this an EI and then FIJ, it's not the same I.
It's the same
I. It's the same I?
Yeah, FIJ is... I have little I matrices EI.
Pardon?
So I have a matrix EI.
For an index that you want to reconstruct.
Right.
Right.
And FIJ are the functions recovering the index. Right? This
and the function depends on which bits you're reading.
Okay.
Right.
The J
is the running index, and I is a fixed index.
So
I is a fixed?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because J represents the indices that you're reading. Okay.
Yeah, I am losing Q or something, or maybe even 2 to the Q or something. But Q is constant, Q is 2.
The number of queries doesn't change. The error,
yes. By constant factor.
All right, but this is where you said take the query.
Yeah, for instance. Good. Okay? Right, so this large matrix simulates the decoding algorithm, which has to be applied to some coding. Seems to be useless. So here is encoding. So here is a sort of a slightly different coding of X, but it's the same. Now I want to encode a message by a positive semi-definite matrix, which adjusts outer product of the C of X with itself. This is a matrix. And it should be an outer product. So we have this vector. If this is C of X, I am multiplying this vector by itself. What I get is a 2x2 matrix, which is 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1. It's an outer product. This is a positive semi-definite matrix, because this is a product of matrix with self-transposed. And it has trace 1, because it has 1 on the diagonal, by normalizing rank. And of course, this is a probability density matrix in quantum computing, but that's where it goes. This is good. So, and here is the thick layer. When I'm applying the matrix EI, this decoding matrix, to this encoding row of X, I'm exactly doing simulating the decoding algorithm on the encoding. This is a one-liner. And I am not going to expand this sort of proof of this explicitly, but this is exactly this. This is just by definition. Great.
Is there any motivation for this definition outside of the
That's a delicate question. The question is basically, how could one come up with the definitions? So, some people might just tell me, there is a chance. Okay? So here is this definition, and it's easy to see that this is basically this. Right? And the corollary is that I have this, if I apply this decoding algorithm and I'm averaging it through all the encodings or vectors with I's bit equal 1, this is a crucial sort of moment. And I know too many sort of, the notation is dense, but this is the crucial inequality. If I apply the decoding algorithm towards the I's bit to all the matrices, sort of to the average of all the matrices with I's bit 1, and I compare this to the same answer I will get when I apply this to all the matrices I's bit 0, I get an advantage of epsilon. This just means that the decoding algorithm recovers the I's bit with probability 1/2 plus epsilon over 2. This is the same in this notation. This means when I average over all the x's, the answer of the decoding algorithm over all the x's with ix bit 1, and I compare it to ix bit 0, I get an integer object. So here we have this matrix question. So this is the end of this step, and you can start sort of listening again. Here's a matrix question. We have this encoding of n lengths, of n bits into positive semi-definite matrices with trace 1. And we have n positive semi-definite matrices, which has a decoding algorithm, which simulates the decoding algorithm. And all of them are easy to check, are smaller than the identity matrix. And we have the same inequality repeated here again. How large should n be? This is a matrix version of the same question.
Sorry, what is the positive semi-definite one?
This is the identity matrix. This is the n by n identity matrix.
PSD1.
The trace one. So as you will see in a second, all of this is not necessary. It doesn't have to be trace one, and this doesn't have to happen. And sort of everything is, you know, slightly robust here, but we go with the same in the same framework of quantum thing. So we have this. How large should n be? This is a matrix formulation of the same question, and actually, you know, this is not that hard to pass through the combinatorial questions for two queries. So is this helpful, right? So we had a combinatorial formulation, we have this formulation, is this helpful? And the answer is yes. So once again, the idea is to simulate decoding by using positive semi-definite matrices. Is this framework helpful? The answer is yes, because there is this theorem of Nayak saying that in this case, capital N is larger than is exponential. Right? So basically, this is the law of the exponential law.
You apply it to the Hilbert scenario for no reason?
Put it, Nayak?
Yeah.
Nayak has his reasons for the bottom curve.
So is this easier to do than the
proves his thing using quantum information. This is hard using all these sort of. So I want to give him a few people. This is it. And I have like 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
Okay, sure. We can try to do this. So this is a fact in quantum information. It could be proved. So this is a fact about matrices. It could be proved using quantum information. But the thing is, you don't have to use the full power of quantum information. Even sort of if you. This is a very simple case. So let's try and do it from first principles. Maybe we'll learn something. So here is the idea of the proof. We need a nice potential function. This is the boson. So I'm going to describe a potential function with some nice and simple properties, and I'm claiming we should have such a function. Then I ask theorem proves. Okay. So what we need a function on the set of positive semi-definite matrices with trace one, with the following property. So think about this. I want to define a concave function over matrices. This is the whole thing. I want to define a concave function, and this is its concavity. If I apply S to an average of two matrices, this gains over the average of the function over these two matrices. This is concavity. In fact, this is strong concavity. In order to have such an advantage, I need a really concave, not a flat function, right? So how does it come? So I need A and B in order to be able to demand this. I need A and B to be different, to be slightly far apart. So what's my condition? I need that there is a small matrix between 0 and 1, such that the trace of E times A is different from the trace of E times B. This is my condition of for these two matrices to being far apart. Okay, so if I have this, and I also assume that S is between 0 and log n on the whole set of these matrices, then I'm fine. Then I claim I'm fine. Sure.
So when you say between 0 and 1, you mean coordinate?
No. This is this means that E is positive semi-definite, and
okay.
This means that identity matrix minus E is positive semi-definite. This is a partial order defined in the column of positive semi-definite.
Okay, thanks.
Right. So of course you would say, right, we know such a function. This is quantum entropy. But it doesn't have to be. This is the point. Any function satisfying this is good. Right. So okay, so let's see how it goes. So here is a claim, if f is such a function, have such a function, then max bound follows. And this is easy, and I'm going to prove it sketchily. So here is a proof of this claim, and then we'll speak about constructing such functions. So here is the first step. Here is the proof of this claim. So the claim is, if you have such a function, then an f bound follows. So let's look at one particular bit I. And the picture above, these two green things connected by orange lines, are two halves of the hypercube. Right, there are all points with xi equals 0 and all points with xi equals 1. And what do I know? I know that if I apply, and I have this matrix ei, and I know if I apply this linear operation, a complete trace of ei times the average of all the images on the left, this is different by epsilon to trace of ei applied to the average of all the images on the right. This is my precondition. So this means that these guys, for any x, this guy and this guy, and these two numbers are different on average, right? The averages are different. And this, you know, so suppose for each x, these two numbers would differ by epsilon. This would mean that this minus this is greater than epsilon squared. But in fact, when we average, we even gain because of convexity, the simple convexity. So this is true for this particular I. So when I average my images in direction I only gain. I gain at least epsilon squared. But now the thing is that I can continue averaging in any other direction, and I will gain again a factor of epsilon squared. It's just because averaging, so now this matrix, this is a matrix, and this matrix now, if you can see it, does not depend on the bit I at all. I'm averaging the row of x and row of x plus I. But now, if I average these matrices in direction j, I'm recovering the average of all the matrices in direction j. Right? So in each direction, when I do this averaging step, I'm gaining a factor of epsilon squared. This is really easy, but the explanation is sort of sketchy. But this is, you know, the point is, think about binary tree, right? So I'm averaging in direction I, but this is a binary tree, but also a cube. To average in direction I and then in direction j, you basically recover averaging direction j. Okay, this you know, you have to believe me about this. This is really a one liner, but the point is, this is true for all indices I. And this means when I'm making n averaging steps, I'm gaining little n times epsilon squared. I do this in every direction, and finally, what I get. So I've started my potential function started at 0, so I know s is non-negative, so it's rotation. So this number, this is the if I take the averaging of my function applied to all the matrices one by one, I have a non-negative number since my function is non-negative. On the other hand, after the whole averaging process, I get the matrix, which is the average of all the images, and I know that s is at most log n. This is another condition, but I gained at least little n times epsilon squared. This gives me the exponential lower bound. I'm looking at the audience and I see everybody is very happy. That we have like 5 minutes left. 5 minutes, right? Yeah, okay, good. So let me, this is a crucial step, basically. This is a crucial step, and then we go to this. I have another two slides left. The point is, you know, if you understand this, the first step, all the other steps are exactly the same. After I average in direction I go to an n minus 1 dimensional cube because I've lost i's coordinate. Now I'm averaging in direction j. I have exactly the same condition. Think about this picture above, which sort of goes up onto the wall, into the ceiling. This looks exactly the same in direction I as in direction j. It's just that it's n minus 1 dimensional now. The whole argument passes through without any change, so syntactically. So I make n steps, I'm gaining little n steps, I'm gaining little n times epsilon squared, I've started positive, my ceiling is at most logarithm of capital N, and therefore little n times epsilon squared is at most logarithm of capital N, and this is exponential robin. This is next theorem. So the only thing which remains to do is to construct this potential function.
So the fact that S of every matrix is most log n was one of the assumptions.
This was one of the assumptions. It's non-negative and everywhere it's most local, right? So we just need to, so what do we need to do? We need to construct a concave function on positive semi-definite matrices. So on here is, right? So how does one construct concave functions on positive semi-definite matrices? Here is the idea. The idea is that, okay. So constructing a potential function. S should be a concave function. This is the picture of a concave function, and should be strongly concave. Looks like a parabola, locally. What does it mean? It means that its second derivative should be relatively large. But you know, we are speaking about functions of matrices, it's not clear what the second derivative means, right? But here's an idea. Our function, which will be defined as following, will sum some strongly concave function, a function with a large second derivative, is a large negative second derivative over the eigenvalues of S. This is the way we are going to construct strongly concave functions over matrices, right? And then we'll have to choose a function phi. So why does it work? Right. So this is, there could be other ideas, but I claim that this is a good idea to use such a function.
The quantum metric is just
this, so phi is t log 1 over t, right? Which is a concave function.
More complicated than necessary.
It's the problem with this function is that its second derivative is not too negative. At some point it's minus one, and one can do better. Okay, this is the second derivative of this function is minus one over t. So t equals one, it's minus one. And we want a large second derivative, a large negative second derivative. So one can try and do better. Right, so this is the idea, we want to use such functions. You know, so why is it useful? So let me try and convince you that at least such a function is concave. And my clue is so let me try at least and prove this fact. And the blue but what it says is that S, such S, is a concave function over matrices without strong concavity. And the whole sort of the main idea is modularization. So let me give you one transparency of modularization. Modularization is a partial order on vectors of length n. So we have two ordered vectors of length n, and they sum to the same amount, sum of ai and sum of bi. So a majorizes b if the largest element in a is larger than the largest element in b. The sum of two largest elements in a is larger than the sum of two largest elements in b, and so on. For instance, A always majorizes a constant vector of its average. This is sort of very easy to see. Right? This is the definition. And here's the theorem. If you have a concave function and A majorizes B, then the sum of phi, a concave function phi, sum of phi over Bi is at least the sum of phi over Ai. Going back to this example, if you substitute this example, phi at average is greater than the average of phi. Basically, this is a theorem going back to Poya and Segev, but the sort of the complexity of the proof is basically this. It's basically going back to the definition of a concave function. Right? This is the theorem. And right, so this is a definition and a theorem, so why is it useful? Why is it relevant at all? And the relevance is because of this. So here's the only thing we need from linear algebra. If I have lambda A, lambda B, and lambda A plus B, the ordered vectors of eigenvalues of three matrices, A, B, and A plus B, then the sum of the lambda A plus lambda B measures as lambda A plus B. This is basically immediate from Rayleigh's definition of eigenvalues. Try it for the maximal eigenvalue, from maximal element on both sides, you get it immediately. The maximal value here is the maximum Y, A plus B, Y, and y is a vector of length 1. Here we're maximizing one parameter, here we're maximizing two, and this is good. So, and the corollary basically, immediately, so here's, now we want to prove concavity of S, and this is immediate, as you can see, and I'm going to skip. Good. Yeah, this is, as you see, it's a one liner, it's three liner on transparency. But the main point is this algebraic fact. So we are almost done. Let me just, so what about
but we need strong concavity. Don't need just concavity, but strong concavity.
Right.
So how strong concavity of phi helps? And this is a so we need to define the notion of strong concavity, and I'm going to run over this very quickly. We just need, you know, so A measurizes B, then at every point sum of A is larger than sum of B. I want at some point it to be strictly larger by something. This is strong concavity, and if it doesn't happen, this there is no strong sort of strong measurizing. Now the next three lines, this is the definition. Sort of, I'm trying to capture this notion of vectors A and B are being far apart by some sort of a measurizing thing. Here, the next three lines are dedicated to Amos Behmel. We had a discussion yesterday of how people write papers, and he said that he really hates when people say this. The following two lemmas of independent interest. So this is especially for people enjoying. So what I'm saying is, let's prove this polysignal theorem where there is strong measurization. And so we need a qualitative estimate of the difference, and there is one. In both directions, and in both directions this is tight, I am basically flashing. So if there is strong measurization, we get some advantage in this inequality, which depends on the secondary rules. And in the other direction, if there is no strong measurization, then we don't get much advantage, and this depends on the maximal secondary rules. This is it. And so using these two lemmas, it's a very simple computation to prove that actually entropy is a good function. Entropy is good, but we are losing some constants. Right, so this is the last. Thank you for the information for me. It's the last transparency. So final remarks. Some easy calculations yet remain to be done, but they are really easy. And so one slightly delicate moment, even if the matrices A and B are far apart, by this condition, it doesn't mean that these vectors are far apart. And this is because the matrices could commute. If they commute, this vector and this vector are the same. So there are two cases. Either the main matrices are non-commutative, then we gain. The other case are commutative, and this is easy. If the matrices are commuting, then they could be diagonal simultaneously, and this is easy, and we can do it by a similar argument. So the entropy function is good. But its second derivative is not that large. It's not that negative. So if you take a function which starts as entropy, see, when t is small, the second derivative is very large. But then, at some point, for some small epsilon zero, you now fix the second derivative and go on with this fixed second derivative. So the function turns into a parabola, into a quadratic function, with a very large second derivative. Right? And this actually gives more information about, in particular, Nayak's theorem is tight if this encoding is basically commutative, which corresponds with the lower bound construction.